Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. We have three budget presentations today, the uniform laws budget presentation, the private detective board, and CRIMNET. So first on the agenda is uniform laws. This is on page two of your budget. Third tab in page. I don't know if you brought your budget books, but the third tab in. So, Judge Davies, do you want to maybe just for new members on the committee, you could tell us a little bit about the Uniform Laws Commission, so we know what we're talking about here, and then you can review your massive budget.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd rather talk about the organization than about money any time, but the Uniform Laws Commission is an organization supported by all the states in the country. It began in 1892 under the sponsorship of the American Bar Association, and it's been active ever since. What it does is, I like to say the only constituency it has are the state legislature, because what it does is draft legislation that we hope all the state legislatures of the country will subsequently adopt in order to make the law uniform in those areas where it's particularly useful for the states to have similar legislation. The organization also takes on some law reform projects where uniformity is less significant. But by and large, what the subject matter that is addressed is a private law area of particular complexity. I made a copy a number of years ago, but I've never been able to get rid of them because no committee ever wanted the copies of the index of the Minnesota statutes where all the uniform acts are listed. We have more than 50 in Minnesota, but That is not even a fair picture of the use that Minnesota has made of the uniform laws, because the acts that have been adopted tend to be of significant length. There's the commercial code, which is the largest single block of law probably in the statutes. Maybe our tax code's a little longer, but I've never measured. But the probate code, most of the condominium law of Minnesota is from the conference. The Anatomical Gift Act, which you're going to be asked to adopt a new version of this year. We think we've got that one greased, but we're not entirely positive. The organization has about 350 members from all 50 states and the District of Columbia and a couple Puerto Rican members. The Minnesota commissioners are Bob Tennyson, former state senator and well-known lobbyist, and Harriet Lansing, a judge on the Court of Appeals, and Harry Hainsworth, recently retired dean at William Mitchell, and the ex officio, the revisor of statute, Michelle Timmons. Then there's a special rule that after 20 years you get to be a life member. So Minnesota has four additional commissioners who have served more than 20 years. I'm the dean, so I've got 40 years in, and Bob Stein, who's former dean of the University Law School, is a life member, and Mike Sullivan, former president of Dairy Queen, and Harry Ross, former revisor of statutes. Have I given a sufficient picture, Mr. Chairman?
I think so. If anyone have any questions about the mission of the Uniform Laws Commission?
I'll loan this to anybody who wants to look at the membership list and all the committees that we've got going now. We just finished a decade and a half, probably, of reworking the commercial code. So all of a sudden there was some elbow room, and we've got so many projects going, you can't believe right now. So we're going to be around here a lot over the next decade. Not that we haven't been around here a lot in the past. But it's an interesting book for if you're interested in seeing the that work that's underway. Our budget, switching to that, is really very simple. You pay for two things. You pay the dues for the state of Minnesota, which is portioned among the states mostly on population, but the smaller states pay a little more per capita than the big states. And the small states take more advantage of it because the staff work, in effect, that the conference does is more valuable to the small states than it is to the big states that are overrun with staff. Minnesota being an average state of average utility, except you have respected our work more than most states, and we're about fourth or fifth most enactments. So we pay the dues. The other thing that is paid is the expenses for the commissioners to attend the annual meeting. It's a week-long meeting, spread year by year in all parts of the country. Sometimes we go south because the rates are cheap in the summertime, and sometimes we go north to a big city where the rates are sort of cheap in the summer. And just occasionally we splurge, and like this year we're going to Pasadena, California, at the end of July and the beginning of August for a week. Well, you pay our expenses. The other thing, and so it's dues and expenses, no flexibility whatsoever. Last time we got chiseled a little bit, and we couldn't pay all our dues. So in the governor's recommendation is a sum to catch up on the dues, and then a reflection of the fact that you just can't chisel us. And so the next 2 years are sufficient to pay the dues and our expenses, we hope. And so we like the governor's recommendation.
Thank you, Judge. Any questions?
I stunned you.
Representative Biskins, you do have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge, what's the cost of a round of golf down in Pasadena? No, just
as a matter of fact, I don't think we have a golfer in our delegation. Actually, Minnesota's got I'm very fond of the Minnesota delegation, and so is the conference. We've had Mike Sullivan has been president of the conference. Bob Stein, now that he's left the ABA, has got in line to be president of the conference. This summer, he will become chair of the executive committee for a two-year term, and then he'll be president for 2 years. So we will have had in recent times two presidents. And Bob Tennyson is chair of the executive committee, which is the committee that, and that puts him on the, he's chair of the legislative committee, which puts him on the executive committee. The legislative committee is responsible for urging enactment efforts in all the states. And I've been on the scoping program and division chair and all kinds of things too.
So.
Anyway, we work hard.
Thank you, Judge, for your testimony. Next, we will hear from the Private Detective Board. You want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marie Ullman. I'm the Executive Director of the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board, and certainly glad to have this opportunity to come and visit with you this morning and have some overview information for the benefit of refreshing continuing members of the committee and to introduce our activity to those who are new. The board is a fee-driven program with fees that are being deposited into the general fund from which the board receives an appropriation. We have five board members who meet on a monthly basis to conduct their primary business and review of license applications, reissuance of licenses, and that sort of activity. Duties are to review those licenses for security and investigative services in Minnesota to ensure compliance with licensing, including training, handling complaints and disciplinary actions, and ensure compliance with the mandatory training. We have over 400 license holders in the private detective and private security services area, as well as 75 approved training providers. Some of the service areas that are represented in the license holder community are uniform guard and patrol services, armored car services, event security, executive protection, corporate investigations, pre-employment and employment investigations, and insurance fraud investigations. Many of these services have become increasingly visible to the public, such as in our shopping malls, business complexes, airports, government buildings, and nuclear plants. They're engaging in providing services that affect issues such as fraud and theft and its impact on our economy. It's estimated that in Minnesota there are approximately 7,000 people that work as employees of these licensed firms. These services provide key augmentation to public law enforcement efforts. That augmentation is validated when the International Association of Chiefs of Police prompts its membership to support regulation of these activities. It's encouraging on law enforcement's part that they seek to expand their knowledge of these services and how they can be used effectively to assist public safety endeavors. There is an increased ratio of private security to public law enforcement. At one time that was 3-1. It's currently estimated that that has approached closer to a 4-1 ratio. In fact, a much larger degree of ratio is being experienced in other countries beyond the U.S. and Canada, for example. In Russia, it's estimated to be about 10-1. I also have the adjunct responsibility and role as the president of the International Association of Security and Investigative Regulators, which is an association of my regulatory colleagues primarily in the U.S. and Canada currently. In that capacity, I receive information concerning many of the world's nations that are involved in the process of regulating these services. Some of these countries include the United Arab Emirates, India, and most recently Mexico has identified a need to organize and regulate the private security industry. Programs of regulation in the U.S. and Canada have served as models to these governments as they identify these services as important areas to the public and to law enforcement. The sustained growth of these businesses has brought about a reliance by the public for their service. The concerns of the industry are shared in terms of professionalizing the service areas. This concludes the overview of our agency, and I believe you have documents concerning our budget request, and I would be happy to respond to any of those requests or follow your leading in terms of how you'd like to go through that.
So I'm just curious, do you serve at the will of the governor, or is the board, or does the board appoint you?
I'm appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Public Safety. Is there anything in the budget that you want to tell us about?
The one thing that I believe that you're familiar with from many of the agencies that are presenting budget requests is the compensation adjustment. That would be the only request that's being made as a result of the governor's recommendation.
Okay. Representative Biston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, I carried legislation for school administrators that actually created a Board of School Administrators separate from the Board of Teaching. And as I look at the operations of the Board of Private Detectives, very similar to what the Board of Administrators does as far as license overview, reviewing complaints, etc. And I know in our budget we have to carry a line item for the cost of that board, but that is offset then in the revenue because it is solely, totally self-sufficient, and it's paid through an addition to the licenses. And my question is simply, is that same process when licenses are renewed or reissued, do the licenses include an add-on fee which then supports this board like school administrators, or is this solely a general fund appropriation?
Ms. Ulmer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is fee-driven. All of the fees are intended to pay for our activity. There's nothing that's added on. The fees are gauged to meet our expenses, and the statute indicates that we are not to significantly over or under recover based on the fees that we charge, but the intent is that we meet our budget request.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ullman, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And now we'll we have the rest of the committee time for CrimNet. Mr. Grid, do you want to? I know we've had we started your presentation and we're not able to complete it, so you might want to do a little bit of review. But I think you have a significant budget request, and we want to know the. The status of CrimNet, your goals, your challenges, and then we'll review your budget. Commissioner, are you, who's starting? I guess we'll wait for the, there we go. You should have this handout, members, but.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the BCA, and, Dale Good, the director of CrimNet, and I are here to follow up from the hearing last week. If I could digress for just 1 minute and go back to the last topic of the Private Detective Board for about 30 seconds.
Sure.
I serve as the chair of the Private Detective Board. I'm one of the five members that meet monthly. I've worked with Marie for several years now. She has done a fine job of staying within the budget, and yet we're trying to do a number of things over the last couple of years to automate and maybe do more applications online. We have involved the industry, the license holders, in training audits and some of those kinds of things. So we're trying to expand and have more partnerships with those in the private sector who have licenses and have them help us streamline the process for both backgrounds, training, and other application and renewal issues. There's no increase in the budget. I'm not pushing for anything there, but I just want to let you know that we are doing our best to try and stay within that and yet also move ahead into the 21st century, I guess. To CrimNet now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, last week we were here and Sheriff Olson testified, Deb Kirshner from the task force chair and John Lally of OET all testified before adjournment, and then we're back now to finish up, and Dale will go through a presentation in a minute with your permission that will give a good oversight, and I think cover where we've been, where we're at, and where we hope to go. I just had a couple of real quick comments. I think in the situation the BCA faces today, I see two areas in technology that are absolutely critical to us. One is in forensics and in science in the laboratory, and I know we'll have a day or some time to talk about that. And the second one is with information sharing, and CrimNet is at the heart of that. We need to have decisions that are made and should be made with accurate and timely information. And if they're not based on accurate and timely information, then the whole criminal justice system is at risk. There are two areas that I just wanted to mention that I think significant progress has been made. One is operationally, and secondly is with relationships with stakeholders. operationally or technically, first I should say in both of those areas there have been setbacks. And Dale will be very candid about this. I'll answer any questions you have about it. There was a time a couple years ago when we could have done much better than we did do. I think that both Deb Kirshner and John Lally, in particular John, talked about the best practices and the audits and some of the standards that we are complying with now much better than a few years ago. But the progress that has been made operationally, I give you just one example, and that's live scans. If you think back to 1997, 98, in that era, fingerprints, when somebody's arrested, they do the 10 rolled fingerprints, inked, put them in an envelope, mail them to the BCA. It would take a couple of months for the BCA to get back to that agency, that sheriff's department, and say, all right, the person who you really had there is Jim Smith. He might have told you he was Tom O'Brien, but that's not who his fingerprints are. He's been arrested in California. Biometrics is the only sure way to know who you're dealing with. I am a volunteer soccer coach, and last night I went to Blaine City Hall and picked up the T-shirts and the roster and all that and filled out, for probably 12 times now in the last 5 years, I filled out the BCA form that then gets sent to the BCA to find out if I can coach children. On that form, I filled in my full name and date of birth and put down my driver's license number, and it occurs to me as I'm filling out with 60 other parents there that this is going in, and you know, I could have lied on that. And how it's a great deterrence, it's a good effort, it gets to a lot of it, but where we're heading ultimately is biometrics. That's the only way we're ever going to know for sure. But live scan, there were 47,000 fingerprint cards mailed in about 10 years ago, 9, 10 years ago. Last year, over 160,000 10 prints were sent to the BCA. 99.9% of them were sent electronically. And instead of putting them in the mail and having somebody open the envelope and sit down and look at that and get back to them in a couple months, they get the response within a couple hours. We are heading towards a response within a couple of minutes. That is huge progress in operationally and technically in making sure that we have the right person and we don't let somebody out that shouldn't be let out. And on the other hand, we're not arresting the wrong person, that we have fingerprints to show this is the right one. The second area I just want to mention real quickly in terms of progress is with our stakeholders. We have been getting very meaningful input through the task force and the oversight group to I think, really have a true partnership. And Dale will go over who's on that and some of the things they've done. But this is, in my view, government at its best. This is not a couple people making a decision and then trying to force that on others or trying to convince others. This is with real, candid, meaningful input. This is digging through the details and working something out. It's painstaking. It's taken a little while. But I am convinced, especially as I talk to other states who are grappling with the exact same issues we are, and they come here and want to look at CrimNet and see what we're doing and see how we're preparing not just to handle the issues of today, but setting the stage for long-term progress. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Good, unless there's any questions for me at this time.
Questions for Superintendent O'Malley?
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. O'Malley, you just alluded a little bit to other states. Maybe you could you just talk a little bit about what the interoperability here is with other states and how this is going to eventually hopefully work?
There are, I think, quite a few areas where this is inevitable that we're going to get hooked up with other states more than we are now. Predatory offender registration is one. There's a project now with missing persons that President Bush passed a bill last year, or pushed a bill last year, that results in Minnesota's gathering, putting together a database of two different databases. One is on missing persons, somebody who's been gone now for X amount of time. There's been hundreds of them in Minnesota, and what we're doing here is we're gathering fingerprints, dental records, and DNA, if we can, from anybody who's just gone missing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a crime, but you know, you can all think of cases. The grandma who was driving to her cottage in Wisconsin and has been gone now for 7 or 8 years, whatever happened to her. If we can get that into a database and hook that up nationally, then the flip side is we have in Minnesota, I think, over 100 unidentified dead bodies in medical examiner's offices around the state. Over 100 of them. We are doing the same thing with that. Putting in dental records, putting in DNA, putting in fingerprints. Common sense would just tell you, if not only in Minnesota, but if we can expand this and It may be that Jacob Wetterling died in a car accident in Arkansas 8 years ago. And he's one of the unidentified in Arkansas. We don't know that right now. So that's one example of how putting a mixture of biometrics and technology together into a database here and linking it up on a common base throughout the whole nation, we're gonna solve mysteries, and we're also going to solve some cold cases. And that's true in any arena you want to pick in terms of technology and in terms of information sharing.
Yeah, I could just add to that. We also, those are two good examples. We also share through NCIC, through the FBI, we share warrant information, stolen vehicle information, and have access to other states. We have share criminal history information and domestic abuse orders for protection. So there is, in addition to these newer ones, there are some ongoing relationships we have with other states and nationally.
Mr. O'Malley, I just have I'm just confused about something on the budget. I don't know if, Mr. Good, you want to address this now or later, but on page 30 of our budget book, it says the relationship to the base budget, and it says this request is in addition to the CRIMNET CGIS base budget of $34 million for 08 and 09, but then when I look at the budget page on page 43, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, the base budget amount seems significantly lower.
Can I explain that in the context of the presentation? I kind of have a slide on that.
I'm sorry?
If I could explain that in the context of the presentation.
Okay,
I have a slide that kind of addresses that.
Okay, we have a different question then. The superintendent, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wanting to know, do you work with the Amber Alert also, or is this kind of different?
No, that is housed in the BCA. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Dominguez. That is housed in the BCA. We have a section in the BCA that deals with Amber Alert and the MCAN, which is the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. Those two work hand in hand.
Okay. If there's no other questions, Mr. Good, do you want to begin your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Dale Good, Executive Director of CRIMNET. Maybe just a little explanation. MS 299-C65 establishes a policy group and a task force, and I serve at the pleasure of the policy group, but my day-to-day supervision is with the superintendent of the BCA. So the Commissioner of Public Safety is chair of the task force. I work for him, but I also am directly day-to-day supervised by the superintendent of the BCA. Our task force, and Deb Kirshner, who is the chair last meeting, spent some time explaining the membership on the task force. Representative Cornish has served 2 years, I think, or more. Longer than that, 3 years. Representative Hillstrom, I guess, has agreed to join us. We try to make that a life sentence if we can, but you know, sometimes we lose membership. When I get to the discussion of the process we use to establish priorities, if Representative Cornish wants to jump in, it's an interesting process of sausage making that I think has had a good outcome. Anyway, that's just a little background on the program office. What I'd like to do is. This is kind of my outline. I hope this is satisfactory. What I'd like to do is do a little bit of history back early 2000, late 90s, early 2000, then talk about 2002 when we had some problems that the superintendent alluded to, where we are today. I have one slide of really trying to explain what CRIMNET is because there's still some confusion about that, and I think that's where we'll talk about those two budget pages. And then the governor's recommendation for 08-09, if that's satisfactory. Some of the early awareness, and I want to recognize Representative Murphy had been chair of this body in the 90s, late 90s, and was involved in some of these efforts. Representative Smith has been involved. Some of our early learning was around the domestic abuse order for protection system that we implemented in the late 90s. And what we learned from that effort, in the past, domestic abuse protection orders were paper. Domestic abuse was a paper-based process where a judge issues an order, it's given to the parties, it's put on file with the sheriff's department, the sheriff serves it. And we were trying to enforce domestic abuse orders that way. And so in the late 90s, we developed through this early, it wasn't called CRIMNET, but through these early efforts of information and integration sharing. we worked on a central database of domestic abuse orders. What we learned from that is we needed to change the business practices, so we had to have judges and court staff entering data on a database where in the past it was just a piece of paper that came from the attorney. We had to have sheriffs changing their whole process of how they served them, because it had been a civil service, serving a civil paper, and now when the information was in the squad car, they needed to be able to do a hit confirmation back to their warrant office. So we actually had to physically move the offices in the sheriff's department. We came back to the legislature for a short form service, so that an officer is at a protected address or sees a respondent in a restraining order situation at the wrong address, they could serve them and then enforce the order. So all of this was much more than just technology. The technology piece, it was, you know, across six different computer systems to get that domestic abuse order to the squad car. But it was a big challenge to manage the agency relationships, the policy, and the business practices. In 1998 to 2000, we had Murderopolis. This was when Time magazine was citing the city of Minneapolis as Murderopolis. We had a couple of horrendous crimes. We had the Kelly Joe Larson murders. There was wide public awareness of the problem of collecting information, for example, on Donald Blum, who was using alias names and dates of birth, including using his wife's name, to be able to work at the VA hospital. We had the first external interest in criminal justice information sharing, and this was the so-called HEALS group, which was a Honeywell-based, originally then Minnesota-based Honeywell, Alina Healthcare, some of the other companies in Minneapolis getting together, and they became aware of the crime information problem. I think Representative Mullery sat on that during those early days. It was also, the HEALS group sponsored some legislation in support of information sharing and integration. It was at that point that the Minnesota Business Partnership also became interested in Target Corporation in particular. The Target CEO was saying, we can track our stocks better than you can track criminals. And that's absolutely correct. And, we struggle even with the biometrics. Unfortunately, we can't barcode our criminals. You know, we could probably track them better. But we do have to do the biometrics. We tried to use this representation in 99-2000 to address what the public probably thought we had at that point in time versus what we actually had. And this is before all the crime. This is before CSI Miami and CSI Las Vegas and forensic files. But the public still had an expectation that we had biometric information, fingerprints, we had booking photos, we knew if the individual was a registered sex offender, we knew if there was a Brady prohibition or prohibition against carrying or purchasing a weapon, we knew the warrant status of the individual, are they wanted here, one county or in another county, we knew their felony conviction record statewide, we knew their misdemeanor record, especially enhanceable misdemeanors, we knew if they were on probation in one county and they were picked up in another county, we knew their probation status statewide. We knew if they were responded in a domestic restraining order situation. We knew if they were on pretrial, are they on release over here, and they're picked up over here. And we knew their juvenile felony record, especially for where the state has extended jurisdiction, juvenile and adult certification of juveniles, we would expect that we would know their serious juvenile criminal history. But what did we actually have? This is what the public probably thought we had at 99-2000. What did we actually have? We had half the fingerprints. We had no booking photos. We had Polaroid. We had no digital booking photos, except in a few jurisdictions we had Polaroids for booking photos. We had incomplete sex offender information in an old clunky system that was not easily accessible. We had incomplete warrant information. Half the felony convictions were not on file. We had no misdemeanor records statewide. We had no statewide probation and detention information. We had no statewide pretrial relation information. And we had no juvenile criminal history. And in addition, as the superintendent said, it would be fingerprint cards, and really were cards, fingerprint cards, inked and rolled, typed on or handwritten, mailed to the BCA. This is just 6-7 years ago. Mailed to the BCA with 3 months to learn identity. In addition, the records that weren't linked, these 50% that weren't linked, that weren't on file, were not visible to the criminal justice agencies. So that's kind of a checkpoint at the beginning of the 2000s. Here's a graphic example of that situation. Here's a fellow. These are the alias names and dates of birth that the system knew of, that some computer system, state computer system, had on record for this. We don't know how many others were out there. These are the ones that we knew of. When we looked on the state criminal history database, he had 6 convictions. When we looked based on his alias names, when we physically, manually looked, went through the paper files and looked through the suspense records, we found a total of 21 offenses. And some of these are lower level sex offenses that could be leading to more significant behavior later. Just one example of this problem of identification. The first funding, where it really started being called CRIMNET, was 2000-2001. The first appropriation was $13 million, and that was for filling some of these gaps. What we had is we had paper files for that information. Where we showed you those gaps, what we had was paper. This is not easy to share. Paper files are not easy to share. So we had funding for fingerprint capture, for statewide probation detention release information, for booking photos, for predatory offender database, the initial funding for the new court information system, and then some local grant funding. In 2001, there was another appropriation, $27 million. I think that was actually reduced slightly during one of the budget cuts. And that created the CRIMNET program office and also appropriated money to continue to fill the gaps, those gaps that I just demonstrated. 2002, this was not a good year. The program, the then executive director of the leadership, focused exclusively on technology. There was going to be a backbone that was going to be built, that was going to be this magic bullet that would solve all of the problems. There was no strategic plan. There was oversimplification, overpromising results, overpromising time to delivery, not understanding the significant business issues in criminal justice, and as you know, both on the funding and the policy end, this is a very complicated area of business, of state business. The result of this is that we were destined for failure. We were set up for failure. Overpromise, undersold, no plan, focus on technology. 2003-2004, Bob Johnson, the current CBIS director of the BCA, was appointed the executive director of CRIMNET. He began to reshift the focus of the program towards the business issues, policy issues. He encouraged broad stakeholder collaboration. I think this is where the task force started becoming a real functioning body that really took interest in the gaps and in the outcomes. A comprehensive strategic plan was created, vetted, and with all the stakeholders, and it was adopted. However, we had a setback. We had another couple setbacks. At the same time we're pulling the program out of the weeds, the legislative auditor released an audit of CRIMNET, a fiscal and a program audit of CRIMNET, that was very critical. It was positive in the sense that it supported the mission of criminal justice information collection and sharing, but it was very critical of the, and rightly so, critical of the way the program was being managed in that 2002, you know, it was released in early 04 and was looking back at 02, 03. At the same time, the program was starting to come out of the weeds. We also had another setback, and that was the MGNO situation. For the newer members, that was a law enforcement incident database that was started initially on a voluntary basis, was moved to the state. It had mixed data classifications without data policy, without a provision in Chapter 13 to maintain it, and it had inadequate security, and it was breached. One of the members of this body, I think, information was obtained. And this caused a huge setback. This caused a setback in terms of trust, your trust in CRIMNET, your trust in our sincerity about being conscious of state data policy and privacy issues. This was a huge setback that we're just now, I think, recovering from a policy perspective. 2005, 2006. So, you know, I'm trying to be very frank about the problems, you've heard the problems, and then show you where we have made progress. One of the areas I can say we've made significant progress is inattention to policy, especially data policy. We have, for example, we've developed what we call a privacy impact assessment. And this is a procedure when you build a new criminal justice information system. It's a protocol for making sure that the privacy interests, the state data policy, is adhered to. And we've adopted that as a standard. We have developed business and technical standards. We have a website where we vet those with our stakeholders. We have quarterly meetings with the vendor community, those companies that develop record systems for the state criminal justice agencies. We vet those standards so they're aware of them as they're building new features into their systems. They're trying to conform to the standards that we are putting out there. We have redone the MDNO. It's called CyberZell, Comprehensive Incident-Based Reporting System. We came to you in 2005 for data policy, I believe, 2005 to have a provision in statute that allows us to maintain the cyber data. We provide direct assistance to local agencies. The MISA system has continued to be rolled out. Statewide supervision has been upgraded. We have an integrated search service that lets you, with a single sign-on, look at 9 different state databases. We'll talk about some of the issues of that, but it's at least a way of trying to get access, simpler access to these databases. We have a statewide statute table that's trying to improve the quality of the charge and disposition information that's retained in all of our systems, particularly the criminal history system. And we have, and the superintendent alluded to this, we have spent a lot of time with our stakeholders as we look forward. And I think that's the process that was the sausage process that I referred to earlier, that over several months we worked with our task force and then with our policy group on saying, here's what we think the future vision is, here's what we think are options for investment for the state to invest in the future. And we had the support, I think we have the support of our task force and our policy group, and from those options, the governor's office made some specific recommendations. So there's a set of options of which a significant core piece of that has come forward. Let's bring it up to date. Here was where we were, 99-2000. Where are we today? We have the fingerprints, we're still missing some, but it's a very small percentage. We have electronic booking photos and an electronic booking photo database, shareable database, and those records are being submitted in all but the 30 smallest jurisdictions in the state. We have better weapon prohibition information. We have a very complete, in fact, I think nationally recognized sex offender registry. Our felony convictions, the most important disposition records, are more complete. We still have issues with warrants. We have a statewide probation detention information. We have a juvenile felony conviction database, albeit with some records in suspense, some records aren't linked to fingerprints. We have a complete domestic abuse restraining order system. We have statewide pretrial release information. And we have, as of 2005, we have all the targeted misdemeanors from February 2005, we have all the targeted misdemeanors from 2002 forward. And as the courts are implementing MNCIS, each county that comes on MNCIS, we go back to 97 when that statute was enacted, and we bring all those targeted misdemeanors forward and put them on the criminal history. So, and the targeted misdemeanors for those that are new members, it's a classification of statute of either the more serious person offenses that are misdemeanors or enhancements. And so it is a classification statute of a particular type of misdemeanor. And the other note here is that, as the superintendent noted, the fingerprints that have grown from 47,000 10 years ago to 162,000, we get those electronically. We're returning identity today in hours, soon to be, hopefully within the next year, to be minutes. And then the bottom note, the bottom yellow sticky representation there, is that our suspense records are visible to criminal justice agencies. So the records that are not linked to not linked to, Madam, Mr. Chair, I just want to recognize Representative Murphy. You weren't here, but I did thank you for some of your early support for some of our efforts, and I did not mention the Skyways.
No! And no brownies or cookies, Mr. Chair?
Just wait.
Keep green.
Mr. Chair, Matt.
We haven't made that a requirement to testify.
I never did.
We had that when you came to the BCA, if I remember.
That was later in the session. Just a note on the suspense records being visible to criminal justice agencies. They, however, are not accessible to statutory background, authorized statutory background checks. And that was one of the issues that in the work that was done by our task force delivery team on background checks and expungements that the, you know, I think we've tried to inform members on both the finance and the policy side that that is an issue, still an open issue, that the suspension records are not accessible for statutory background checks, including human service background checks. By law, they're not. All right, what really is CRIMNET? And I think this is the $64,000 question. CRIMNET is not a thing. It's a program. It's about 20 people that work with our stakeholders statewide. And this is, you know, when you heard Deb talk about the task force, two sheriffs, two chiefs, two city attorneys, two county attorneys, corrections, courts, public members. We work with our stakeholders. We identify strategic information priorities. We develop policy recommendations and standards. And we recommend the investments. And we're required by statute to do that. 299C65 requires that we come to you with recommendations on future investments in information technology. And we understand how difficult it is for you with all the different priorities that you have. And we understand what we are coming forward is some recommended future investments that we are required to do by law. And we understand how difficult it is in your situation with looking at all the competing priorities. But we are obligated to come forward with our recommendations. And this is these recommendations are with the support of our stakeholders. The CRIMNET Program Office-Based Budget, I know we'll get to that, your question, Mr. Chair, on the those two different budget pages. The CRIMNET Program Office has an approximately $3.1 million base budget. What you see reference to in those two different, the page 30 and page 43, I believe, is page 43 is the base budget plus the change request. I got that page number right.
43, yep.
Yeah. So the numbers you see on page 43 is the existing base budget plus the change request. The reference to that larger number on page 30 is referenced back to the CJIS, the Criminal Justice Information System, part of the BCA. And remember, the CRIMNET is the program office, so we're the ones recommending information investments in information technology. Historically, that has been in multiple agencies. It has been at the BCA and CJIS, as many of these will be that we're recommending that is in the governor's recommendation. It's been in the courts. It's been in the Department of Corrections for the statewide supervision system. So there have been large investments, but the CRIMNET Program Office is a relatively small base operating budget that does the standards, works with the stakeholders, recommends future investments. Those investments go into multiple agencies and divisions, including the CJIS division of the BCA. I hope that clarifies that, both what the program office is and your question on the difference between those two pages.
Well, then which page is your actual budget on then?
In the Department of Public Safety. About page 46.
No. So you were referring, I believe, Mr. Chair, you were referring to the on page 30 is in addition to the CRIMNET CJIS base budget of $34 million. That's really those two. This is the budget for CRIMNET on page 29. I thought you were asking a question about the reference on the paragraph in relation to base budget.
Yes, I was, and I think you've clarified that. Okay. So that's CRIMNET and CJIS base budget.
Correct.
Total.
Just a couple more slides here. I'd like to give you this context. Why CRIMNET? We looked in, I have an update, well, I've updated it for a large period of time, but just taking 2004 as an example, the state, the cities, and the counties spend approximately $2.3 billion to operate the criminal justice system. And in this, what we did is we went to the state auditor's website. This excludes much of the capital investment, so when there's large jail or detention facilities, this operating budget. So if we spend even a percent of this to provide the information to get out of paper and to create contemporary technology information sharing capabilities, you know, that's a small amount of money in relationship to the operating expenses that we pay for the criminal justice system that's making decisions. And I think this is what you were referring to, Superintendent, is every criminal justice practitioner is making decisions every day. That when they stop a vehicle, before they approach it, with the decision to arrest or detain, the decision to release someone or detain them, the sentencing decisions, the correctional programming decisions, the charging decisions, all of those are or should be based on complete and accurate and timely information. And we're spending $2.4 billion a year, even in 2004, to operate. We need to operate. We need to make decisions based on information. So that's really the rationale for PRIMNet. Okay, where are we going? When we solve the problems in the, you know, this 99 to 2000 to today, when we filled gaps with silos. We built separate computer systems. That's all we could do at the time. So we have a statewide supervision system, the new card information system, predatory offender, the booking photos, all our separate systems. The vision for the future is to integrate those, consolidate the information that's makes it easier to use, makes it more helpful, and eventually link all these records back to fingerprints. What that lets us do then in the future is to be able to deliver based on the role of that individual and the particular event. So, for example, an officer in a squad car stopping someone needs different information than an investigator that's sitting in a back room, or different information than a judge that's making a release decision. So the thrust of the recommendations that you'll see are to consolidate the records that are in these systems that have been built in the last few years, and then link them electronically and be able to deliver them back and back to the device. Is it going to a PDA? Is it going to an MDT in a squad car? Or is it going to a computer in an investigator's office or in a courtroom? We can't do that yet today. And these next steps are the top priorities of our stakeholders, of our task force. Specifically then in the budget book, the name event index service, this is linking records electronically and eventually linking them to fingerprints. We came to you last year for the data policy for us to be able to create the name event index service. We already have, in anticipation of this, we came to you and you approved the data policy for the name event index service. An electronic charging service. Today, when we charge, it's a paper process. In the metro area, we have officers driving paper around to get signatures. We have officers off the street because we're driving paper. So we want to pilot an electronic charging service where the incident information from law enforcement to the prosecutor with signatures and then to the courts and filed signed electronically and filed to eliminate the paper process. We've been working very closely with the courts on this, with the public defenders on this, to make sure that as we move into an area of digital signatures or electronic signatures, that, you know, we still meet the legal test for charging. The consolidated view of information is some technology that lets us tailor information around the subject or a decision event. Single sign-on is, again, these are the items that are in the budget book that support this vision. The single sign-on is the security, the ability to have security where users are accessing integrated systems or the information sharing behind the scenes system to system is secure. So we've done in the past year and a half, we've developed a security plan. That security, and it's difficult enough, as we know from the incidents that we've had. Security is difficult enough in a single agency. It's even more difficult where we're going sharing information across agencies. So we work very closely with the Office of Enterprise Technology, and as they are starting to ramp up their security effort to make sure that our effort is consistent, and that our focus, though, is a little bit different, and that is this multi-agency focus. The LiveScan replacement, this is replacing 88 LiveScan units. There's approximately 170 out there. This replaces 88 that were funded by Katie's Law, that original appropriation in 2000. There is some added benefit, though, in replacing them, and that is that we are also able to capture, with the new devices, we can capture palm prints. And we estimate that up to 40% of crime scene prints are palms, so that gives us additional ability to support latent processing of fingerprints with these new devices. The last item is the update of the criminal justice reporting system. This is a 30-year-old system that's no longer supported. It's the way we report our crime statistics to the FBI. With the ability to update this, we intend to be able to provide better information to the legislature about crime information. Just a visual representation of where these new LiveScan units, the LiveScan replacement portion of this budget is approximately $5.2 million. And that goes all around the state. Those 88 units go all around the state. Approximately 42% of this budget is support, either placing equipment out in the cities and counties, or is support of those local information systems to be able to participate in this initiative. So again, the money goes to multiple agencies or to multiple locations around the state. Mm-hmm. These are the counties where the LiveScan units, the replacement LiveScan units, would go.
The other ones have them.
The other ones have them already, I'm sorry. So the white are in place. And, some locations, Hennepin County, the larger counties and cities, there's multiple units.
Are you done with your presentation, Mr. Gunn?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I have a quick question. We have several people who have questions, but I just wanted to say that I appreciate your frankness in discussing the problems that CrimNet has had and apparently has overcome, and your goals to make the CrimNet more user-friendly, and I think everybody on this committee wants to see CrimNet finished. People have been around here for a while. We supported CrimNet from day one, where we recognized the problems with agencies not being able to communicate with each other. And I was the co-author of Katie's Law back in whenever that was. My question is it's a huge amount of money, and I think this committee is prepared to make this a reality, but I'm wondering why. It seems to me, when we've looked at data compiled from other states, that we've spent more money, $200 million, I think, over the course of this project, more money than any other state, save New York, for an integrated criminal justice information system. And I don't mind being number one in everything, but I just... It's a lot of money, and when we did an analysis of how other states have funded their integrated criminal justice system, it seemed that most states use some kind of a fee system to fund it. Some rely solely on federal funding, and others even used bonding for their networks. Yet we're so heavily dependent on general fund dollars. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas or have thought through, or the board has thought through, some combination of funding mechanisms that could make completion of this a reality but not take such a total hit on the general fund.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take these one at a time. As far as bonding, let me take that first. There was a recommendation. There was a bill, I believe, in 2002, 2003 out of the House, but I think Representative Wiginius sponsored that. Maybe it was earlier than that. And what I recall coming back is that bond counsel, the interpretation of the Minnesota Constitution with respect to information technology is it doesn't meet the test, the useful life test. I think that was the decision that came back. We even had, at that point, we had the business partnerships with some of the companies suggesting that we should be bonding for this, but we had a reading from bond counsel that that wouldn't work under our constitution, or at least the bonding agencies would not bond for information technology. With respect to other states, in a former life, I worked for SEARCH, the National Consortium for Justice Information and Statistics, where I spent about a year and a half flying around the country doing consulting, technical assistance on information, these kinds of initiatives. So I spent time in Maricopa County, Phoenix, time in the state of Illinois, Rhode Island, Iowa, all over the country. You really need to be careful about an apples and, you know, apples to apples comparison. Some initiatives are very big and some are very small. Some are statewide, some are not. Some are only, you know, one agency to another agency. I think we have one of the more comprehensive plans and programs that you'll find around the country. Having said that, if you look at the analysis of those expenditures, and I can look at, you know, when I was the court IT director, and I look at those numbers that the legislative auditor reported, some of those numbers were basic upgrades in court information technology to be able to get away from paper. Even the ability for the district court judges and staff and trial court judges and staff to be able to do documents on a PC. So I would challenge you to look in any area of state government, any line of business, and go back and look what's been invested from the early 90s to today as they've tried to get away from this, and I think you're going to find equivalently large numbers. So, the CRIMNET program office that's making the recommendations for investments is a relatively small amount of money. The investments over time in trying to get away from paper and to automate, yes, that is significant. I just read an article last week that the Kaiser Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, is replacing its computer system. $4 billion. They're investing $4 billion in replacing their computer system. You look at what the airlines, I've gone out to Northwest. You look at what Northwest spends on information technology. So again, I don't want to diminish how significant some of these investments are in terms of the pain it is to fund these. On the other hand, you know, we have made demonstrable progress in filling the gaps. We have a very clear plan for moving forward. We have the support of our stakeholders. We're managed appropriately. Our people that provide oversight of us say we're doing it the right way. So I hope that gives you some confidence that in moving forward. That
Mr. Good, I have all the confidence in you and CRIMNET and that you're moving forward. I just want us to be open to some possibilities of some other ways of funding CRIMNET so the general fund isn't taking 100% or such an enormous hit because of the decline in federal funding for these systems. We have several members of questions for you. Representative Liebling is first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Good, I just want to say that, I have worked in the criminal justice system, and I totally understand the need to get this data. And I think that, if we can just think into the future, having this system really up and functioning, I think would be huge and would save us a lot of resources going forward and a lot of human misery besides, which, of course, we can't quantify. But, I have kind of two questions. First of all, just a basic question, Mr. Chair. Many of us don't have the budget book with us, so if you could just tell us what the numbers are, I think it would be helpful to the committee just as a starting point.
You want to, which numbers?
Well, what the request is.
Here. Mr. Carter, you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the total budget request for their new initiative is $6.955 million in fiscal year 08, and for fiscal year 09, it's $8.584 million. And those five areas that Mr. Good covered make up that request.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing, my other real question was about kind of following on what the chair asked, but I just wonder, going through the history that you did, and I do appreciate that. It's a little painful to go through, actually, and I appreciate your candor there, too. But I just wonder, to what extent are we really just trying to reinvent the wheel? Are we not looking to other states to see what they're doing? I mean, you didn't really talk about any models that might be out there. Are we just leading the pack where there's nobody to follow? And doesn't the federal government have any role here in terms of trying to set standards across states? You know, if there's got to be some interoperability issues for, you know, reporting this data to the FBI and so on. I mean, how is that all working?
Sam Liebling, Mr. Carter, did you want to put one more blank here on Representative Liebling's question, and then we'll have Mr. Goodrich.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I may have skipped over this, but I think you also wanted to know what the base budget is of the CRIMNET, and currently in the budget book that's found on page 43, and it shows, for example, for fiscal year 07 that they had they spent $3.517 million in general fund appropriations, and they also received at that time $1.149 million in federal funds.
And then the governor is recommending $22 million over the biennium. Mr. Good, do you want to respond to Representative Liebling's question about...
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, as far as the federal standards, it's starting in approximately 2000. There's been, along the way, there's been several. NIBRS is National Incident-Based Reporting as a federal standard, and we would adhere to that in that last item of the change request. We would be looking at that federal standard for NIBRS. In terms of integrated information sharing, the real federal effort didn't start till right around September 11th, the 2001-2002. And there's an initiative called Global Justice Information Sharing. There's four committees of Global, and I chair one of the work groups on standards. So I meet with a national group that's supported by the U.S. Department of Justice that is trying to set national standards. And, in fact, they are paying a lot of attention to CRIMNET and to Minnesota because we are out. We are, I think, ahead of the pack. And we, in fact, are influencing the standards. The state of Minnesota is influencing the federal standards. The other advantage of being on this national group is I get to see what other states and jurisdictions are doing. I get to talk with my colleagues and see where we can share. For example, in the warrant area, where we have been talking to the people in Maricopa, Phoenix, because their first effort was in the area of warrants. Sometimes you can share technology, but other times you can share some of the learning. The standards are important, but you can also share how they went about it and what obstacles they encountered that saves us time moving forward. So every opportunity we have to look at national standards or to look at what other jurisdictions are doing, we try to take advantage of that.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have a question in here somewhere, but basically I'd just like to have a couple comments from you. First, I compare this a lot to the Amber Alert system and how we've seen over the recent history how that's been positive and how that's really the quick notification and then the quick reaction has really been prevalent. One of the things I'd, I guess, like for you to address is providing that we proceed with this, what about the upgrades in technology that, you know, we've come so far in technology recently, and just kind of maybe a brief comment about that, and maybe a little bit about how the local units of government, I look at Cottage Grove, who just this past year went to 800 megahertz, you know, and that was a significant cost. Just if you could address a couple of those.
Mr. Good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, that is always a challenge. I think the advantage, you know, the change in technology, and I've been in technology 30 years. I think I started in technology. I was I was an officer in the Navy, and I was on a ship that supported intelligence gathering for the National Security Agency. And we had a satellite dish that we could talk to Fort George Meade, you know, very, very, very early satellite technology. So I've been kind of a
a technology geek for 30 years, and I've seen a lot of changes. I think the big difference today is with the internet-style technologies, there is more of a standards-based way. There's both a market standard and some technology standards that makes it easier to share, that, you know, makes the technology piece a bit easier than it used to be, and maybe makes it not quite so driving in terms of the upgrades, you know, taking advantage of additional features and advantages.
Representative Diskins, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm, you know, not shy in saying that. This stuff really scares the bejeekers out of the classic liberal in me, all right? And I'll put that out front. Fortunately, that's a very small part of me, Mr. Chair, and so I'm not going to jump off the any roof. I want to connect three dots on three different slides, all right, and just ask the question on how we're dealing with this, and that's on slide 11. You mentioned the MGA NO breach, right? On slide 19, you mentioned the integration of the silos, right? And then finally on slide 20, you talk about a single sign-on, right? Give me some comfort that the security of that data is absolute highest priority, and that it isn't about getting all this data together so that people can run amok wallowing in all this wonderful data, and that, you know, the privacy of the individual remains paramount. If you told me that biometric sign-on, all right, is a direction you're looking at, that would give me some comfort. So I guess that's the issue I'd like addressed.
Mr. Good.
Well, data policy and security are, and I cannot say that strongly enough, how seriously we take both of those issues, and they're related issues. Chapter 13 and other areas of statute tell us what we need to do. It doesn't tell us how to do it. The BCA, if this gives you any comfort, the BCA in the technology area, we had an independent audit. We had an independent firm come in and audit. This was before the breach, before the DVS breach. Because of our relationship to the FBI and the FBI standards, we are very, very careful about security. We are working very closely with the Office of Enterprise Technology on security and our approach to security. And we are, as I said, we came back on some of these initiatives, on this name event index service in particular. We came to this body in last year and asked for a classification for that in anticipation of the fact that we would be building something new. We also came in 2005 and asked for the data policy for cybers, so that we did it right this time, that we had appropriate authority from the legislature to collect the law enforcement incident information with the mixed classifications. So I don't know how much more to say than that. I am totally sensitive to what, you know, the issue that you have, and I can tell you that our program office is very sensitive to that. Our leadership at the BCA is very sensitive. The obviously Commissioner of Public Safety at this point and his group are very sensitive to that.
Representative Bissons, we have five more members of questions, so
this is a yes or no question, Mr. Chairman.
Good.
Have you looked into cybermetrics? Have you looked into cybermetric sign-on? Biometric sign-on, I'm sorry.
Mr. Good.
I personally have done that in my court experience. But last Friday, we did that in the context of e-charging. We looked at three or four different biometric technologies for both signing on and electronically signing a document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Superintendent O'Malley.
If I could add
a yes or no, I'm sorry.
Superintendent.
Mr. Chairman, members, if I could add one other thing. In addition to the policy and coming and making sure the data is classified properly and giving you a year's notice of what we're planning to do, there's another element that I think you could draw significant comfort from. When I was at first starting police work in 77, 80, if I wanted to find out about somebody, I would walk to our record section, I'd flip through 3x5 cards, or I would call a friend in another agency and say, tell me what you know about this person. That would be private data. There would be no record that I ever did that.
no one could know I did that. If I went and checked on my daughter's boyfriend, nobody would know. That's an improper use. Today we have an audit trail that checks all that. We had a case very recently of a police officer in the Twin Cities area who improperly accessed data and, in fact, put a BCA agent's life at risk because that was an undercover police officer and checked on it for a criminal. That person was prosecuted in federal court and convicted of doing that. We take that, as he said, at every level, not only the policy in advance, but in the practical effect of this. Somebody checks something out, even if it's a one-time sign-on, we know exactly who did it, when, where, and for how long they were on.
Representative Smith, are you, you're up next.
No.
Do you have a question?
No, I have no question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Good, a three-part question. First, does this take into account the new, that some started in Massachusetts, I think, with photos across this, and they've been catching a lot of criminals? Second part is, what do we, if we are ahead, and then when we have to connect to other states in the future, such as criminals aren't staying in Minnesota or vice versa, what is going to be the cost to redo and how do we do that? And the third is, I remember I was the legislative representative on Minnesota Heels Back, which was kind of the instigator of this, all the corporations and things like that, and they offered to lend assistance of their expertise on technology, and I guess I was hearing from them again, not the actual technologists, but the people that were more in charge, said that they kind of gave up working with the state on that, and you said that there was too much emphasis on technology, and we lost, it seems like we lost a lot of donated time. How did that all, what went wrong with that setup?
Mr. Good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mori, with respect to photos, we have the booking, the MRAP, Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos, has booking photos that are shareable. They can do facial recognition. They can do lineups, digital lineups with that. With respect to the national sharing, I think we mentioned this a little bit earlier before you came into the room, but we do, through NCIC, through the National Crime Information Center, we do share with other states. They are linked to other states in a number of areas. The predatory offender data, the warrants, stolen vehicles, driver information, the criminal history, domestic abuse orders. So there are, and there are new areas that, that the superintendent mentioned that in terms of were the ones that you that were new.
There's a number of other ones that are going to be. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, not only within Minnesota, but interstate that, that we're working. The missing persons I mentioned a while ago, some of those in the
Representative, did you get
well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't really get, I, with regard to the photos, they're identifying a lot of criminals through the system with the photos they have, and then there's like through scan cameras or whatever at scenes or different things. Or, and I guess you didn't address that. I didn't think you addressed what's going to cost us to get involved with a national network or something like that because we've got all these criminals going on, and then I don't think you addressed the third part at all.
I didn't address the third
part. Mr. Goodyear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, we are already connected, so this is there has been ongoing relationships with FBI with information sharing across states in a number of areas, number of different types of data. That's ongoing.
I understood that. How do we get
that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. How do we get that integrated? I know there's ways to stop and do certain things across, but how do we really integrate with that, or is that not a goal in the future?
Mr. Good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, we are integrated through NLIS, through NCIC, to a national network. We are integrated in specific areas of record types. So that is an ongoing.
Superintendent.
And Mr. Chair, if I could offer one other example, we are anticipating all those needs, the full integration nationwide. And I'll give you one example of the cyber that took over for MJNO. That is an incident-based reporting system so that when law enforcement enters that data into cybers, it can be shared within Minnesota. However, it's also been designed so that it will be compliant with NIBRS, which is the national incident-based one.
By doing that, law enforcement is required by the FBI to report statistics nationally every year. Rather than having two separate reporting requirements, if they participate in cybers, we simply push a button and all that data goes to the FBI as well as to you so that they have accurate criminal information on the types of crimes, number of arrests, types, all those kinds of things. So that's an anticipatory event. Right now they have to do two separate functions. They had MJNO, which is gone, but they also had to report nationally. They were required to report to the FBI. Now one system can do both. If that's anticipating the kind of federal connections that we see coming.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, could he answer shortly the third question?
What was the third question?
The third question was the target, the outside corporate.
Excuse me one second, Representative Zellers.
I just wondered, there was a lot of expertise offered to us, and I just wondered what happened, because I heard they gave up working.
Mr. Good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, Mark Kleineman, who is from Target, on the IT side of Target, has been a very active member of our task force, and we do, you know, is there at the table on some of these initiatives. We also do meet regularly with some of the Target leadership. But you're right that it's been other in terms of active, you know, direct support, that was early on. We haven't had that, other than Mark Kleineman continuing to be very active at the task force.
Representative Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the questions to answer, so I'll just a brief question and a couple of comments. I'm glad to hear you're working with the Office of Technology and Enterprise. I think having one central location to work technology, and Mr. Chairman, I share your concerns for funding. One of the things that I've been with the Drive to Excellence and some of the technology offices, we don't reward some of these savings or initiatives. So if you use a computer system or technology and save your budget, your division, your group $1 million, here in government we just snatch it back. You know, maybe a set-aside fund for future technology improvements. If you save $1 million, we'll set it aside so it, next year you need to buy new software or updated materials. I think that would be a novel idea in government where we'd actually encourage people to save so at the end of their budget year they don't go out and just spend on whatever. And the bonding for technology, I think is coming, and we're way behind. We're not going to be building bricks and mortar as much as we used to. Technology is all around us, and the fact that we don't allow a bond for a computer system to track criminals, to me, is probably one of our biggest failings as a, you know, as a body. A public safety, to me, is our number one responsibility. But Mr. Good, one of the things that you kind of got around, and I want to just make sure, because I did speak with you and I know the answer, but the hacker and the security, using more internet-based and using more technology, you know, let's face it, there are criminals out there that get smarter and smarter and sit and evade and work up viruses and ways to hack into systems, and I know that's a concern to lots of folks. Just if you could kind of give us just a little bit more background, maybe a little bit of detail, we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Gooden, we're going to go a little bit over our time so we can accommodate the remaining questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did a basically a comprehensive plan for security in an integration environment, and we created a test facility to test in an integration environment. We've taken that plan and we've been working with the Office of Enterprise Technology. So we've shared that plan with them. They've reviewed that plan. And then as we go forward on actually implementing something, so right now we have the plan. Each system has its own security, but for these new initiatives, we are participating with them, for example, on the single sign-on, what the OET is going to do for single sign-on. So in fact, there's a meeting this afternoon of that group. So we are very actively involved in that. I don't want to sit here and promise you that, you know, something could always happen, but what I can tell you is I take it very seriously. We plan for it. We develop testing facilities for it, and we work we work very closely with OET.
Representative Cornish is next.
Mr. Chair and members, realizing you're short of time, I just wanted to give a quick validation to the testimony of the two testifiers here. I've been on the board for the last couple of years, and we struggle with all these issues. Security has actually gotten a lot better for the couple of people, at least here, that were worried about it. And like the superintendent says, Years ago, we used to be able to walk in, and we had these huge Rolodex things with all the personal information we had free will to. And now, with the sign-on, the future sign-ons, I think the security will be a lot better. I can tell you a bore story for a half an hour of all the people that we've let go over the years. I've had a rapist in the back of my squad car once that, on a traffic violation, let go, not knowing who he was, with no instant information. Had another time, had a deserter from the Navy in the back seat of my car, let him go without any knowledge who he was. And then one funny comment is one time we did know who somebody was, and they had a warrant out for him, and it said body only, which usually meant pretty serious. It was out in the woods, so my partner got him. We handcuffed him behind his back. We put him over the top of the squad car, started searching him for safety's sake, and then finally we got the information that the warrant, after 15 phone calls, was failure to return a video to a local grocery store. We had this guy spread eagled over a car thinking we had a desperate criminal. So the moral of the story is information is really important to the user in all these things, and it's been a joy to work with these folks for 2 years, and they have really solved most of these problems. So.
Got it. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked on page, 29? Oh, 43 of the budget book. I just noticed on there the full-time equivalents have gone from, in 2006, from 18, and they're going up to 34. Maybe you just want to talk about that.
Mr. Good.
You should be going to nine.
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Good, I think the increase might be attributed to some increase in personnel due to your new change item. Is that a possibility?
There is some in that. But also, our complement is higher than our current staff, and we're trying to figure that out, too. We have vacancies in here. But what the change request is going to be?
Nine new positions in there.
Nine new positions?
In the tails in the new request.
Mr. Chair?
Superintendent?
I think our request, if I recall correctly, adds five positions in 08 and nine in 09, and part of it might be, Mr. Carter, as a result of the compensation of the increase, maybe? Is that why we're not?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, members, no, I think the compensation increase is just for salary increases, but if you look on page 30 of your change item request, you'll see that under the technology funding detail, personnel costs are $544,000 in 08, and it goes up to close to $1 million. So I take it that would be new personnel.
Mr. Good, maybe you can provide us with this information, unless you have a quick response
now. We're pretty certain that what you're showing as far as the current is less than we have vacancies that we've had difficulty filling. Our complement is 26, but we've been running around this 2022. So if we add 9 to the 26, that gets us up to the 34.
And why are you having difficulty filling them?
Some of the technology classifications, again, the marketplace, we struggle with some of the technology classifications.
Could you also provide the committee with, at a later time, since I think we need to adjourn now, as to regarding the purchase of the live scans, whether those could be leased, and whether we could maybe do that over a period of years to maybe reduce the budget a little bit, given the needs that this committee needs to address. I would appreciate your analysis of that. Superintendent, Mr. Good, thank you so much for your testimony. If there's no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.